It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
My colleague Kaylee Lyons is back for a second day now, having heard briefings from authorities. Let's get the latest right now on this recovery mission. It's a rainy day in Baltimore. Kaylee, what can you tell us?
Rainy indeed, which is complicating the recovery efforts that are underway. That together with the wind, the choppiness of the water, the low visibility, and of course the massive amounts of debris that workers are dealing with and trying to recover. The six individuals, construction workers, who were on the bridge when it collapsed, who are presumed dead at this time. Now, as you say, we have seen a number of press gatherings happening here over the course of the last day and a half. We heard earlier today from the Maryland governor, Wes Moore, who was talking about how recovery is his number one priority. And when asked questions about the investigation, said right now it still is simply too early to know many things. He also, though, did point that he will be working together with officials here in the state of Maryland, as well as the congressional delegation in Washington and federal authorities, to make sure funding is secured, not just for the rebuilding of the bridge, which, of course, President Biden said will be paid for federally yesterday. He promised that, although Congress will need to sign on, but also locally. The Maryland state legislature does have efforts underway as of today for income replacement for the thousands of individuals who will be affected by the closure of the Port of Baltimore, which of course cannot operate as normal at this time and won't be able to do so until all the debris and the dolly, the vessel itself, has actually cleared the waterway.
We don't have a sense of when they can get that boat out of the way, do we, Kaylee? I know there are 22 other ships stranded, blocked essentially inside the port. I presume they can't leave until the dolly does.
They can't leave. No one else can get in. It really is frozen until all of the waterway can be declared safe for vessels to transit once again. And as for time, Joe, all officials we have spoken with thus far have been very reluctant to put a firm time estimate on the reopening of the port or, of course, the reconstruction of the bridge, for that matter, which is likely to be a much longer term project. I know you'll be speaking with Secretary Buttigieg later on today, and I'm sure he will reiterate some of what we heard from him yesterday about how this is not going to be quick. It's not going to be easy. He also said it's not going to be inexpensive. We are talking months, if not years, in terms of reconstruction, and it could potentially be months until the Port of Baltimore is flowing and importing and exporting is happening out of here once again. At this point, it's just really difficult to know for certain.
Do you see boats out toward the dolly, Kaylee? We know that the NTSB managed to board the ship last night. They got the equivalent of the black box from the dolly. Are they out there now, or was that kind of a one-time mission?
No, they will continue to work aboard the best vessel. I actually did speak with an official from the NTSB earlier this morning who said they do plan to board today. There is a 24-person team who will be part of this investigation. And it's not just about getting the data recorders, which, of course, as you say, they have obtained one, but also about conducting interviews on those aboard, really trying to get an understanding of what exactly was happening on the vessel in the moments up to it losing power, losing propulsion, and ultimately colliding with the bridge, working with counterparts in Singapore as well, considering this was a Singapore-flagged vessel, and the owners and operators have to be considered here as well. So that's an investigation that likely, too, is going to play out over the course of some period of time. As for what is actually happening on the water, we do know that there are sonar operations underway. The Coast Guard is working actively with the Maryland State Police. The FBI is here as well. The Army Corps of Engineers will be involved in this. Really, you are talking about a cross-agency kind of cooperation that is happening at the state and federal level here, Joe, and all of these workers have been working essentially since 6 a.m. this morning when I got here. That is when this recovery effort officially started today.
Well, you're really bringing that to life for us, Kaylee. Thank you so much for the reporting. Get yourself back to Washington safely. Kaylee Lyons, who would normally be in the chair next to me here on this broadcast with a lot of really important information there. And I'll add the fact that this still being a recovery effort, divers expected back in the water today. We still have six people missing and presumed dead, which is something that we still need to remember, even as we talk about the logistics behind this massive project and the economic impact of this bridge collapse. We talked about the funding mechanism and whether the federal government will be able to handle this in a conversation that Kaylee had yesterday with Senator Chris Van Hollen, the Democrat from Maryland, had this to say.
There are some funds in what's called the Emergency Relief Fund. This is a fund within the Federal Highway Administration that is there specifically for this kind of emergency. So once the state makes its submission, which I think they're going to do very shortly, some of those funds can begin to be drawn down. Now, for the larger, longer-term costs, yes, we're going to call upon our colleagues in Congress.
Chris Van Hollen speaking yesterday. His colleague in the House, Glenn Ivey, joins us now, the Democrat from Maryland's 4th District, with us live on Bloomberg TV and radio. Congressman, it's great to have you. Your thoughts today on a funding debate that's about to begin. Can the federal government get this done?
Well, first, I just want to extend my condolences to the families. You know, the hearts are with them, and, you know, the prayers continue to go out for the six who are they're still seeking to recover. With respect to the funding issues, Senator Van Hollen's absolutely right. And he was very aggressive and quick to get an outreach going to the Department of Transportation for the emergency funds. And we appreciate Secretary Buttigieg making some of those available. We'll see how much, I think, in the very near future. And certainly President Biden's commitment to get federal funding for the rebuilding of the bridge. The congressional debate, you know, we're in recess right now, so it hasn't really started back yet. But I think there's already outreach efforts going on. As you know, we've had challenges in the House in particular with respect to just passing basic legislation. But we've been able to get some things done when necessary. The last week, you just passed a bill, $1 trillion funding bill for keeping the government open. And I'm hoping that this will be the type of tragedy that brings people together instead of pushing, you know, people into partisan corners. And I'm hoping we can get something done here relatively quickly.
Well, we keep hearing it's different than it was, Congressman, in 2007 following the bridge collapse in Minnesota. And I think I understand what people mean by that. But do you believe it in this case, or can people come together on this?
Well, I hope so. I mean, I think, you know, there was some instances in the past where we've had politicians who've, you know, made political stands on these kinds of issues. But as my mother used to say, what goes around comes around. And I remember one or two of them having to come back hat in hand when there were, you know, disasters in their states and they needed help. And President Biden stepped up to help them, even though they were Republicans in red states. So I think we can find a way to do it. And, you know, certainly there's an economic need that's beneficial to the entire country. I mean, you're talking $15 million a day, 15,000 jobs. This is a port that had been, I think, a quarter of coal exports for the country had been going in and out, going out of this port. So I think it's important for us, you know, regionally and nationally to get this thing done.
Well, so Congressman, what does this mean in the interim for your state of Maryland, for your district? Even if this money was approved tonight, we are told this is not a months, but years long project. You just talked about a potential 6 week outage for coal. At least we understand the number of autos that come through the Baltimore Harbor, the port, could be redistributed to a lot of places. So I know there's a long-term concern about permanent displacement, but what do you do if this is 2 or 3 years, the number of jobs that are relying on this?
Yeah, I think that's the question of the hour. I mean, I think we've got the short, medium, and long-term issues that we have to address. In the short term, I think it's clearing the harbor, getting the packages and the containers off the ship that's stuck there so we can move that. And the ships that are also stuck in the harbor can move out. I think we want to try and get shipping back up as soon as possible. I think in the interim, I think we've got to figure out, you know, what it's actually going to take to rebuild the bridge. I don't know if it's going to be a new bridge that's next to it or if they're going to try and repair the one that's there. I don't know if those decisions have been made yet. And I think the long-term piece, you know, it took 5 years to build that bridge, as I understand it. And, you know, that's almost 50 years ago. And, you know, there may have been some technological advances, but it's still going to take a long time to get it done. So I think we have to figure out how to work around that. We've got commuters who travel in and out of their work every day in and out of Baltimore. We've got people who, truckers in particular, have been using that route. They're going to have to find new ways to move their products. And we've got just, you know, people traveling up and down the Eastern Seaboard. So all of that's going to be challenged. I think we're going to have to look at some sort of intermediate impact assistance to try and help, especially businesses and employees who are getting hammered by this in the near future. And, you know, we'll see what we can do on that front. But I think it's going to be important to see what we can do.
Well, I wonder if that might be included in an emergency relief package. Congressman, is there anything the delegation can do to make permanent the business that exists now in the port of Baltimore? If these cars go to Newark or New York or they go down south, what says they come back?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question. We're going to have to play it by ear a little bit. I think in the short term, you know, we might be able to provide some sort of subsidies to help these businesses deal with an immediate economic impact. But I think a reality of this is that they're going to have to try and, you know, relocate their businesses to some extent, at least for the period while the port's being restored. Hopefully we can get that done relatively quickly, though, so there won't have to be any long-term changes. I think the bridge is a different question. Businesses that rely on using that bridge for shipping and transporting, that's going to be tougher because that's going to take, I would think, at least several years to make that a reality. So, but the hope is we can get the port back up and running quickly enough so businesses don't have to take any long-term steps to revamp or relocate their businesses.
We're spending time with Congressman Glenn Ivey of Maryland this day after the bridge collapse. I know this is a big deal locally, Congressman. We're talking about regional and national impact here. But for a lot of folks who live in Baltimore, it was not only a landmark, not only a way to get to work, it was just part of their day-to-day life here supporting businesses that we have been describing. There are six people still unaccounted for. Can you talk to us about the emotional impact that this is having on Maryland?
Yeah. I think it's really been devastating. I think there's people have really been hurt. You know, it's cut to the heart, I think, on this. And, you know, people who feel for the families who are grieving, people who feel for the community, which relies so extensively on the economic impact that's going to be had by this because they work in or around the ports. And I think, as you mentioned, the sort of the symbolism of the bridge, just to see it down in the water like that, I think is, it's heartbreaking for sure. So there's a symbolic piece of this that's going to be challenging. I think Governor Moore has done an outstanding job of being the healer in charge and taking a strong leadership role and trying to help us recover, certainly economically, but also psychologically and emotionally to the loss that we've sustained here.
You want to see Joe Biden pay a personal visit? I know Pete Buttigieg has already been there, but would a presidential visit be in order?
We'd love to have the president come. But frankly, I mean, the most important piece of this so far, of everything that's happened since the bridge collapsed, was the president's commitment to make sure that we get the bridge back up and the Fed's going to take the lead in restoring it and making sure that the funding is taken care of. The other thing he said that I liked was we're not going to wait for, you know, litigation to sort all of this stuff out. If there's restitution down the road, that's great. But we want to take the lead in getting the bridge up immediately and not have to wait for the courts to work out who may or may not be liable. And I really appreciated the president's position on that. And also his message to the people of the community. I thought I really appreciated what he's done and said already And, you know, we look forward to working with him to make sure that Congress can get its piece of this done as well.
Glad you could be with us this day after the collapse, Congressman. Thank you. Glenn Ivey, Democrat from Maryland, with us on Balance of Power as we carry on with our panel next. Rick Davis and Jeannie Shanzano are on the way on the fastest show in politics. This is Bloomberg.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you're here as in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Let's assemble our panel to spend some time on this Wednesday with Rick Davis and Jeannie Shanzano, Bloomberg politics contributors. With this debate underway now, you've already got, Jeannie, Pete Buttigieg out on TV today making the case for federal funding. This White House knows that it probably won't go the way it did in 2007. We keep hearing about this. The bridge in Minneapolis followed quickly by a unanimous approval of funding. We're told it's different now. Do you believe that?
Yeah, I mean, I hope not, but all signs are that it is different. But I applaud the president, obviously, the governor of Maryland, who Kaylee was just talking about, and of course, Pete Buttigieg, so for getting out there so quickly, and the president for making the case that the United States, the Congress, needs to move quickly to rebuild this really important bridge and waterway, which obviously is critical to shipping in our nation's capital and on the East Coast and around the world.
What's going to happen, Rick Davis, when Joe Biden drops a supplemental emergency funding request for this bridge? He's already got one hanging out there for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan that has been very controversial on Capitol Hill. Will it feel different when it's put on paper?
Will it feel different? Yeah, it'll feel heavier and more likely to sink to the bottom of the bay, just like this bridge has. Look, I mean, there's nothing that's going to pass this House of Representatives between now and Election Day, other than potentially the Ukraine supplemental. And that's only because the gravity of it all, with all due respect to the people of Baltimore, it's going to be a while before they even know what the costs are going to be to reconstruct this bridge. And I think, frankly, Joe Biden would be much better off making this a part of why he needs to be reelected, because he's got a track record on infrastructure. He's been successful in getting $1 trillion dedicated to U.S. infrastructure, and that he can get this job done for the people of Baltimore if he's reelected. And so I can't imagine a scenario where you're going to see between now and November of this year a substantial funding package of billions of dollars go through for this specific project.
Well, that's a reality check, Jeannie. Does this bridge become a campaign issue?
Yeah, I think it is going to be a campaign issue. You know, it is Republicans who have been talking about the fact that they don't want to invest abroad. They want to make America great. They want to invest at home. Well, here's your opportunity. And Joe Biden will say that. And, you know, there is a scenario in which we get a vote on this, although I agree with Rick, it may not come to pass. But how about if the Democrats do a deal with Mike Johnson to keep his seat in return for votes on these supplementals? It would be really important to see which Republicans are going to vote against fixing this critically important bill, particularly given their mantra has been help the United States spend money at home. Well, here's a chance to do it. Mm-hmm.
Here's a chance to do it, but it just doesn't always come that easily. Rick, I know you are more optimistic about Ukraine, and I'd like to ask you about that with the idea of this no-interest loan that a lot of people scoffed at a couple of weeks ago when Lindsey Graham brought it forth. Donald Trump has mentioned it, but I keep hearing about it. Is there going to be legislative language at some point that reflects it?
Well, there's only one person more important than the Speaker of the House for determining what goes in this bill, and that's Donald Trump. And he's already made the view that maybe it ought to be a loan. And so that's one of the reasons why you're hearing so much of it. I mean, he is the mouthpiece of the Republican Party, the Congressional Republican Party, the Gubernatorial Republican Party, you name it. So you're going to hear that more and more because Donald Trump wants that to be the talking point. That's why Lindsey Graham's making a point of doing it. He went to Kyiv recently and told them that he would support funding for them if it came in form of a loan. My guess is the folks fighting the war on the front line don't care if it's a loan or cash on hand. They don't care how they get it. They just want it because they need the equipment to be able to fight Russians. And so my guess is it'll be part of the conversation, but that means that we're making progress by actually having a vote in the House. And all that could get ironed out in a conference with the Senate, because obviously the Senate bill wouldn't have that loan provision in it.
We'll have a chance to talk more about the campaign next hour, Jeannie, but Joe Biden's got a lot of water to carry right now. We're talking about funding a bridge. He's trying to make the case for Ukraine. Last evening made quite a bit of news talking about abortion in North Carolina. He's got to deal with the economy, dealing with inflation. At some point, do all of these messages just drown each other out?
No, I don't think so. You know, I think the president can make all of these important statements on the campaign trail. Last night was critically important in North Carolina, the first real joint appearance between Harris and Biden in a long time on the campaign trail, even though it was a White House event, technically. And it just shows you how much import they're putting into this issue of health care, particularly reproductive rights, which is so much on the minds of so many of us, given what's happening around the country. And of course, they see North Carolina as a state where they can go on the offensive, as opposed to the defense they're playing in so many of these battleground states. So North Carolina, critically important, as is this issue of health care for women and people across the country, and our ability as Americans to make our choices about what we do with our bodies, ourselves, and with our doctors, and not have the heavy hand of the state involved in that. And of course, you're seeing Donald Trump grapple with this as he thinks about potentially finally saying, okay, we get 15 or 16 weeks on abortion. So, you know, he knows that the writing is on the wall for this reproductive issue. It is not a winning campaign strategy for Republicans, as we saw in Alabama with this special election.
I look forward to talking with you both about that, because it is important, although to see the nation obsess over a state rep in Alabama is pretty remarkable and tells us a lot about where we are. What's Donald Trump's message going to be on Ukraine, if not the same one we've been hearing, Rick, that I can solve this in the first 24 hours if I'm reelected?
Oh, I don't think he ever gets into any more detail, because there is no more detail than that, right? It's just the power of his personality is somehow going to part the seas and settle a conflict that's now been going on for into its third year, and some would say since 2014. It's just irrational that anybody can snap their fingers and repair that bridge. But look, he's not going to back off of that consideration. He will be even-handed because he loves Putin. And so whatever's good for Putin is good for Donald Trump. And so I think we've already heard from Zelensky that he would be very nervous about any kind of deal that Donald Trump would do, because it would likely leave the Russians in control of large swaths of territory in Ukraine, which the Ukraine people would find completely unacceptable.
Rick Davis and Jeannie Shanzano, our signature panel, back together today.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts, or watch us live on YouTube.
The number of vessels sailing through the Southern Red Sea is down still 70% compared with the start of December. Container shipping has dropped 90%. Gas tankers have also all but ceased transit. Peter, it's great to see you. I really appreciate your coming in. What an adventure you had to see all of this up close. These numbers are stark. That would suggest that we haven't made a dent in this problem.
You know, the Houthis have a lot of material which the U.S. says is supplied by Iran. They have missiles which continue to come in on these small boats across the Red Sea, across routes supplied by land. Mm-hmm. And so they're able to keep going for quite some time.
It's kind of amazing that we haven't, based on some of the reporting we've heard from the Pentagon, made a bigger difference. We've expended quite a bit of firepower at going after targets, in some cases mobile targets, preemptive strikes, we're told, in Yemen. Have we at least slowed down the attacks?
So Pentagon officials do say that they've seen the pace of the attacks slow. And they've also seen a shift in the kind of tactics that the Houthis are using. So, for example, early on, they were flying drones high up and mm-hmm. using them for surveillance and reconnaissance. Now they're flying drones straight at targets in the Red Sea on one-way missions to disrupt. And the Pentagon sees that kind of adaptation as a sign that maybe they're running low on some of the missile stocks.
They're still just as aggressive in posture, though. What are they getting at, by the way? What's the aim? Is it to sink a ship? Is it to get us out of the region? Obviously, that's not going to happen.
So the Houthis say that their aim is to act as the voice of the people of Gaza. Mm-hmm. And they say that their attacks will stop once the war between Israel and Hamas stops. The truth is, I think, though, that they have a lot to gain politically from this. If you look back to before the October 7th attacks, there were anti-Houthi protests in Yemen. The parts of the country they can control were not being especially well run, certainly not doing well economically. Mm-hmm. But these, October 7th kind of gave them a cause. It gave them a chance to step up and say that they were the voice of the Arab street. And that's worked out pretty well
for
them.
So this is a big PR campaign in the end. They don't care about sinking a ship just as long as they're in the headlines.
Well, if they can get headlines by sinking ships,
well, sure,
and score some points against the U.S. too, all for the good for them.
How has our strategy evolved, if at all? You were on board an aircraft carrier, and so you're seeing a number of different platforms. They can shoot cruise missiles from ships, from destroyers. They can obviously launch fighter jets like you saw with air-to-ground attacks.
Right.
Does it remain all of the above? Because the criticism has been, you know, we're lobbing million-dollar missiles at these very cheap drones that at some point is going to be a problem for the Navy.
It's very expensive. The price tag goes up every day. I did ask on board the ship about whether cost is ever a consideration, and they said no, they're focused on mission until Washington tells them to spend less money by using cheaper systems. They're going to focus on what accomplishes the mission mm-hmm. best. And, you know, U.S. officials say that freedom of navigation, freedom of commerce is a core U.S. interest, and they're going to keep fighting to defend that, even though the price tag is pretty high.
Does that battle group stay in the region until the Houthi problem is solved, until the Gaza problem is solved, or both?
I think it's all of the above.
They first went there because of October 7th, right?
That's right. Yeah. They left Virginia thinking that they were going to do a bunch of Mediterranean port calls,
right,
which has not worked out the way that they hoped. And they're going to need to stay there until the Houthis either run out of missiles, change their mind about what they want to do, or there's peace in the Middle East. And anyone who has watched the region for a long time knows they could be waiting for a while.
Yeah. Having spent a minute on an aircraft carrier, it's a remarkable experience to be in this floating city.
Right.
You've got 5,000 people living on that ship. Peter, what was morale like?
I would say morale was pretty good. People are tired. A lot of people working 12-hour shifts day in, day out. They have a leadership team on board, which is very dedicated to improving morale, stressing the mission that they're going after, stressing why it's important, why it matters. Mm-hmm. So it seems to be holding up for now, but I do think that they know it can't be held up forever at this pace.
And they have no sense of when they're ending this mission.
Not just yet.
The no-fail mission, as you call it in your great reporting. Peter, thank you for coming to talk to us.
Thank
Welcome
you.
Back home. Peter Martin in a great piece that I encourage you to check out on the terminal or at Bloomberg.com. It's not just great reporting, but also loaded with images from Peter's visit to the USS Eisenhower, which is just a remarkable thing to witness. All of this, of course, comes down, again, to shipping. It's not just the conflicts in Gaza. It's the flow of shipping. It's trade, and it comes down to prices, because as they continue to steer around the Red Sea, and we've got a lot of them here, as I mentioned, container shipping has dropped 90%. Gas tankers have ceased transit. They've got to go somewhere. It adds time and money, and it ends up being inflationary, as we've discussed before with Molly Smith. It's just yet another problem for the Biden administration when they think about unwinding supply chains and something like this happens. Add a bridge collapse in Baltimore, and we can keep talking about this. Now, I mention this in part because Molly Smith is in Washington, typically covering the indicators and the data from New York. She's with us here in the Bloomberg DC Bureau, and it's wonderful to see you.
It is. What a treat.
To Balance of Power.
On the desk.
Well, yes, here at the desk. Great to see you. We're talking about inflation with kind of a reference to every possible story, whether it's geopolitics, whether it's supply chains, whether it's supply and demand or a Fed conversation. And you've been helping with some reporting here that people are going to read about, that disinflation is the word of the quarter in retail.
So they say.
They've seen some goods prices come down. They're keeping their retail prices even. So fatter margins for retailers, bad news for Joe Biden, because when you go to the store, you don't see a difference.
Well, that's exactly the issue that Biden and many Democrats have been arguing really for years now, this concept called greedflation.
Greedflation.
Yes. Well, they actually were arguing it more when prices were going up, that companies would then charge even more so than needed to offset those rising cost pressures and taking advantage of inflation that way. Mm-hmm. Now it's moving in the reverse, that even though prices are easing for some of these key input costs, they're still keeping the prices charged to consumers high, so keeping the margins elevated in that way. So economists will kind of go back and forth as to like whether this argument is valid, as to whether is this a really main driver of the overall inflation we're experiencing? Probably not. But is it contributing at the margins? Yeah, maybe so.
Yeah, it's kind of like what we experience at the gas station, right? The prices tend to go up real quick and take a long time to come back down. The problem is, folks like you who look into the future here a little bit and study the data don't see that as a continuing trend necessarily. That's why we've got interest rates higher for longer, right?
Exactly, right. So if you look at the disinflation that we've seen in the last almost 2 years, it's pretty much entirely come from goods, like, you know, things that you buy, like stuff, like furniture, like clothing, things that you can actually pick up and touch, like this keyboard, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so it's a good side on one and energy on the other. But those two things aren't really falling as much anymore the way that they had been for the last 18 or so months. So that's the concern now looking forward. And Fed officials, including Chair Powell, have flagged this as well, that they're wondering how much more room there is to run on this goods disinflation story.
Right. So, you know, you hear a lot about last mile. Do you roll your eyes at that? Is that like an easy cliche? How come the last mile is so hard?
No, I think that's really valid. And that's what we've been talking about, really, this whole disinflationary journey, getting from, you know, 9% up in June 2022 down to hopefully what will be 2% in the next year. But that's it's really hard to cut it in half and then in half again. So coming down from, you know, that area and 8 to 9% down to 4, that was what was called the easy part. That was what we saw with a lot of the supply chains healing, helping out, doing a lot of the work for the Fed on the energy side as well, with those prices coming down. The harder part now is the stickier parts of inflation, like services, with all of us still wanting to travel and go out. I was just at the Miami Open last weekend to support watching a tennis event. Lots of people there spending on entertainment.
Yeah.
People still want to live their lives.
So
and that's
what is
the hard
that,
part.
Though? You can't get a table at a restaurant, at least in a place like Washington or New York, you know, where the elitists experiencing, I guess, the benefits of this economy that won't seem to quit. But it's not just here. Like you said, book a ticket on an airplane. Is that still COVID savings? Is it just the fact that the job market's doing well?
I think it's a bit of both. Granted, the COVID savings are certainly waning.
You think so? Yeah.
Yeah, that's certainly been a big there, I mean, I feel like you can talk to five different economists on where are excess savings at, and they'll give you 10 different answers.
Well, that's true. We've heard some ring the bell to say, you know what, we spent it all. There's none left. And then years later, you hear that it's still, in fact, driving some behavior. But we've also seen wages go up quite a bit, too. So I wonder how that plays into it. The fact is that this revenge travel thing, I still think, is real. Whether we have the money to do it or not, people are still, I think, responding to that pandemic in some ways. When they have the opportunity to do something, they take it.
Yeah, a lot of these plans were, you know, that we put off during COVID were longer term things that still could be playing out now, like, you know, 2 or 3 years later, you know, like booking a trip to go away for a long weekend or longer than that, you know, people still catching up on weddings that didn't happen then, on other kinds of, you know, big life events, buying homes. So a lot of this is still probably playing catch up to some degree. And as well, that people are moving on. I mean, this whole concept of, like, you know, maybe the economy, like, we're not having a hard landing, it seems like. There's really no sign of a recession. Maybe we're not having a soft landing either. It's more this concept of a no landing where the economy just reaccelerates and moves on. And I think that's a lot of people more are conjuring around that idea now.
Well, reaccelerates makes me think that second half of the year could be a different world for the Fed then. If this is what we're looking at, maybe interest rate cuts are just further away than anyone believes.
Probably more. That could be one idea. I mean, certainly the Fed wants you to believe that. They don't want the market to get ahead of itself.
Yeah.
But there's also a big difference between the economy reaccelerating and inflation reaccelerating. Mm-hmm. So it is possible, and this is what the Fed is hoping for, that growth can be sustained without a pickup in inflation. And a lot of that comes from the supply side being back in order to support the demand that's obviously still here.
I know there's a term for it, but Joe Biden's made a big deal about the smaller portion sizes. You know, you buy a bag of chips.
Shrinkflation.
Thank you. So I knew you would see
me on
that. he's made that part of his stump speech. He talked about it at the State of the Union. He had a video on social media with a bag of potato chips. Does that get worse as retailers are pressured to follow prices lower?
I mean, I'm not a retailer, but
they don't
want to
give up those
margins. No, of course not. I mean, there's also, like, the idea as well that you kind of see this in housing a little bit too, that I think we've seen data that average new homes are actually being built with less square footage. So,
how about that?
Yeah, it kind of, like, can go in multiple ways there.
Shrinkflation. Not to be confused with shrink, which is a whole other problem that retailers are facing. I love the jargon. I have to ask you about PCE is on Friday.
It is.
That's actually a pretty big deal for the Fed.
Yes. So some of us will not have Friday off.
You're one of them.
We will be working. Yes.
Wow.
We will give you all the news.
Short straw.
Yeah. But, you know, hey, when it comes to the big inflation report, that's kind of our Super Bowl.
Well, what are we looking at? What's the expectation? Do you know off the top of your head?
Yeah. I mean, it's going to be it's going to be a reading that probably will make the Fed a little uncomfortable, but they are obviously well aware of a lot of the inputs that go into PCE we've already seen so far. So a lot of economists have really already firmed up their forecast and have a good idea of what's coming. So we've already seen a lot of the other data point to strong price pressures in February that will probably still continue. This report is for February, which seems like ages ago now.
Yes, right.
But I think they will probably be prepared to look through that and just, you know, be more prepared for what's to come.
You'll hear about it here, of course, on Bloomberg. We will actually have live special coverage. PCE data, 8:30 a.m. Wall Street time, again at 11:30 with remarks from Jay Powell. So join Nathan Hager and Michael McKee here for that. Big thanks to Molly Smith. Get home safely. It's great to see you in Washington. Thanks for listening to the Balance of Power podcast. Make sure to subscribe if you haven't already at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find us live every weekday from Washington, D.C. at noontime Eastern at Bloomberg.com.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.